Most of us are familiar with the concept of a minyan. Certain prayers involving sanctification of God's name, such as the Kaddish, Kedusha, and Baruch Hu, can only be recited in the presence of 10 Jews above the age of 13. Moreover, the public recitation of the Torah on Shabbos, holidays, and Monday and Thursday mornings also requires a minyan. Traditionally, the minyan was comprised of 10 males. In recent years, women seeking greater participation in the religious service have requested to establish their own minyanim, and a number of Orthodox communities have done so. And of course, the conservative and reform movement has long recognized women as being counted for a minyan. The questions that I want to address tonight are, number one, according to Jewish halacha, can women be counted for a minyan, the necessary quorum of 10 people for certain prayers? Number two, can women be given aliyot? Can women be called to the Torah to recite the blessings before and after the Torah reading? And number three, even if the halakha does not prohibit women's participation in the service, is it necessarily a desirable or proper thing to innovate within the framework of traditional Judaism? At the outset, in analyzing the permissibility of women being counted for a minyan for the necessary quorum, there are two different issues that have to be considered. First of all, does the halacha permit a mixed minyan of, for example, 5 women and 5 men? Here, there's an important consideration that must be kept in mind, and this is the idea of the mechitza, of the separation of the wall that divides men and women in an Orthodox halachically observant service. Contrary to popular opinion, the need of a mechitza does not derive from any notion of women's inferiority. On the contrary, the need for a mechitza derives from the fact that men's temptations tend to be weak, they are very easily distractible by sexual stimuli, and there is a serious belief that men and women sitting together in a service would tend to lead the men astray and deprive them of the proper concentration in their davening, in their prayers to God. Consequently, the very need of a mechitza, the notion that men and women must sit separately at a Jewish religious service, seems to negate the possibility of combining men and women in a single group for a quorum, because the need for separation obviously negates the possibility of unity. This, however, merely argues against the notion of combining men and women to constitute a single minyan. The second question, a more difficult halakhic question, is, however, can there be a minyan that consists exclusively of 10 women if there are no men present and the law of mechitza is therefore not being violated? At the outset, it should be made clear that the Shulchan Aruch, the definitive code of Jewish law, does rule specifically that a minyan must consist of 10 adult Jewish males above the age of 13. So as a matter of law, certainly the mandatory minyan must consist of 10 males. But let's try to analyze why this should be the case. Before we consider whether or not women can be counted for a minyan, for a necessary quorum, we first have to analyze whether or not women have an obligation to pray. Because to the extent their obligation of prayer is not the same as that of a man, obviously they would be incapable of the same responsibilities and obligations as men have. The Mishnah in the Tractate Brachos, Chapter 3, Mishnah 3, states specifically that women are obligated to recite prayers on a daily basis. There is, however, an argument among the commentaries, namely Maimonides and Nachmanides, the Rambam and the Ramban, as to what is the nature of a woman's obligation. The Ramban, Nachmanides, understands that a woman's obligations in prayer are exactly the same as a man. She must recite the full Shemona Esrei, both for Shachris, both in the morning and in the afternoon as well. Maimonides, on the other hand, takes the position that a woman's obligation to prayer is not coextensive with that of a man, and her obligation is not to recite the Shemona Esrei in whole, but merely to recite a petition in any text of her choosing one time a day, as opposed to a man's obligation must daven the Shemona Esrei in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. According to Maimonides, therefore, since a woman is not obligated to recite the whole Siddur and the whole official text of the davening as we have it today, it is understandable that a woman cannot be counted for a minyan simply because she does not share that particular concrete form of davening which the man is obligated to perform. However, according to Nachmanides, the Ramban, a woman's obligation is exactly the same as a man in terms of the recitation of the Shemona Esrei. It therefore becomes more problematical. Why is it, therefore, if a woman's obligation is the same as a man, why is it that she cannot be counted for a minyan? And here there are two possible explanations that one can offer, one from a strictly technical halachic standpoint, and the other in terms of a psychological analysis in the difference between the way men approach holiness and the way that women can achieve that same lofty goal. First, from a technical halachic standpoint, let us look at the origin of a minyan. In Leviticus chapter 22, verse 32, the Torah writes, quoting God, "And I will be sanctified among the children of Israel." The Talmud states that all prayers involving the sanctification of God's name, namely the Kaddish, the Kedusha, and the Borchu, may only be recited in the presence of ten. The word among is used in Leviticus and is also used in connection with the spies, where the Torah writes, "Separate yourselves from among this evil congregation." There is a method of interpretation of the Bible called the Gezeirah Shavah, which means if the Torah uses the same word in two different places, this is to indicate a similarity and an ability to learn out the laws of one area from the laws of another area. Since the word among is used both in the context of sanctification of God's name and in the context of the spies, just as the reference in connection with the spies referred only to 10 spies, since Joshua and Caleb did not participate in the conspiracy of the spies, so too the reference to the sanctification of God's name necessitates the presence of 10 people. Thus, a davarsha b'kedusha, a prayer involving the sanctification of God's name, necessitates a congregation, which through the hermeneutical principle of Gezeirah Shavah, similarity of wording, is defined as a group of 10. On a mechanical level, therefore, the congregation, which consists of a group of 10, must share the same characteristics as the spies, all of whom happen to be male. Thus, the very same reason why the congregation must consist of 10 people necessitates that those 10 people be male. As the Talmud states, "Ein gezeirah shava l'machza," any comparison made through a similarity of wording cannot be halfway. On a deeper level, the exclusion of women from the minyan expresses an important distinction between the roles of men and the roles of women. The woman's role, traditionally, is to cultivate and develop the private part of life, the home, the family, and the inner virtues of modesty and reticence. The male is perceived as a public figure. The idea of relating to God in the context of an Eda, the Torah's word for congregation, connotes the necessity of communion with Hashem, with God, in a public forum, on some type of community-wide basis. The female, however, has no need to relate to Hashem in such an open and revealed manner. Her interaction with God is more intimate, more private, and therefore more direct. A woman is not counted for a minyan because, for her, the very concept of communal prayer assumes less importance. A second aspect of minyan is the fact that to truly become part of a unified community, certain aspects of individuality must be surrendered. A minyan is not simply an assembly of 10 separate individuals, each of whom goes their own way, but a new entity, persons who have temporarily at least submerged their very identities into a communal mass in order to relate to Hashem on a more exalted, uplifted level. Because of the imperfections and sins of man, it is difficult, if not impossible, for him as an individual to fully relate to God and proclaim the requisite words of sanctity. He needs the sense of community. He needs the idea of being part of an entity greater than himself before he may approach the divine. Women, by virtue of an innate perfection already built into their lives, neither need this submergence or loss of identity, nor would such obliteration of self even be desirable. In short, a man approaches God by transcending himself, and a woman can approach God by being themselves. Drawing on a biological analogy, we can see that a man creates by giving up, thus in the creation of life, man creates life by giving up some of himself. A woman, on the other hand, creates life by nurturing that which is within her. The minyan is a surrender of individuality, the merging of oneself into an aggregate of individuals, becoming a new entity. There is, to some extent, a self-obliteration. There is a destruction of the individual in terms of becoming part of a greater whole. The woman, on the other hand, is called upon to do a task which is far more exalted, if perhaps more difficult, and that is to nurture those innate qualities within herself to relate to Hashem. Many commentaries point out that we can also see this in the commandment of circumcision, that man's perfection is a function of development and change. Thus, he is born imperfect and needs circumcision. Woman's perfection is a function of nurturing the qualities that are already there, and thus the further process of circumcision is technically unnecessary. This analysis may explain why there are two areas where women could possibly be counted for a minyan. One is the recitation of the Megillah on Purim, and two, establishing a public group for the purpose of having to give up one's life before one transgresses the Torah in front of such a public group. This is the obligation of martyrdom or sanctification of God's name. The purpose of requiring 10 people for the reading of the Megillah is not because the Megillah is in the category of a Devar Shebikdusha, a prayer of sanctification. Indeed, the name of God is not even mentioned, but simply because it is a mitzvah to proclaim Hashem's miracles in a public forum. Thus, the need for a minyan in the case of a Megillah does not necessitate the fusion of 10 individuals into a new transcendent entity, greater than the sum of its parts, but simply that 10 people be there. When 10 individuals, rather than a single entity, is all that is required, women can also be counted, since this type of minyan does not involve the obliteration of the self that is normally needed. The same is true for martyrdom. As long as a Jew is called upon to transgress the Torah in the presence of 10 Jewish individuals, whether or not they are fused into one community, he must sacrifice his life. Consequently, women too can constitute all or part of this public group. Let me now briefly address the second question that was raised earlier, and that is there anything in the halacha that would prohibit women from receiving aliyot, from being called up to the Torah, and reciting the blessings before the Torah reading and after the Torah reading? Here we have a very interesting Mishnah in Tractate Megillah that says as follows. All persons may receive an aliyah to the Torah, including minors and women, but the rabbis said that a woman should not read the Torah publicly, because of respect for the congregation. The Hebrew term that is used here is kavod hatzibor, which means respect for the congregation, and I'll explain momentarily what that means. First, before proceeding to analyze this Mishnah, it must be remembered that the procedure for the reading of the Torah in Talmudic times substantially differed from the present day. In Talmudic times, it was only the first person that would make the opening blessing, and the last person would make the last blessing. The intermediate aliyot would not recite anything. A number of commentators have said that the Mishnah's permissibility for women to receive aliyot in the absence of respect for the congregation concept is limited to the intermediate aliyot where women were not reciting the blessings. Today, however, since all persons who get aliyot do recite blessings before and after their portion, even under the law of the Mishnah, women could not have aliyot. Thus, many have said that the Mishnah's kavod hatzibor concept is essentially irrelevant for the halachic issue today, simply because today we are dealing with the recitation of a blessing, which was not involved in the time of the Mishnah. Other commentaries, however, say that even where blessings are recited, women would have been able to have aliyot even today, except for the reason of respect for the congregation. The question then becomes, why is it considered disrespectful to the congregation for a woman to be honored with an aliyah? What exactly is the problem that the Mishnah is sensitive to? Rabbi Moshe Meiselman, in his book Jewish Law and Jewish Women, suggests that the concept of kavod hatzibur, respect for the congregation, was not intended to denigrate women, or to intimate that it would be embarrassing for men to accord a synagogue honor to a woman, but rather he offers two possible explanations. First, similar to the idea of a mechitza, the wall that separates men and women during a service, giving women public roles in the synagogue would be sexually distracting to men and would prevent both men and women from attaining proper kavana, proper intention, during the Torah reading. The idea of separate seating in shul, as I mentioned earlier, is primarily due to the weaknesses of men and certainly not to any notion of female inferiority. That is one reason. So one reason basically is that we don't give women these public honors in a mixed congregation because that would violate the notion of mechitza, which in turn is necessary for people to have proper kavana, proper intention during davening. A second reason, a second problem might be that women have a lesser obligation to study Torah than men. Now, this, of course, can be an entirely separate discussion, but basically, one of the 613 mitzvos is the study of Torah, and it must be emphasized that the mitzvah of the study of Torah is not merely a means to an end. It is not merely so that the observant Jew will know what to do. Obviously, one must learn to know what to do, but even if one were to know all of the totality of Jewish law, as vast as it would be, he would still have an obligation to study Torah anyway, because that is one of the primary ways that the Jewish man relates with God. Well, the Talmud in Kedushin tells us that although a woman must, of course, study Torah in order to know what she will do in terms of her mitzvot, there is no per se in terms of her particular commandments. Obviously, she has to learn to know how to live as an observant Jew. There is no intrinsic obligation on the part of women to study Torah once they have achieved this particular instrumental goal. And of course, none of us ever really achieves it, but at least in theory, there is no per se obligation for the study of Torah. Let's go back. Why that is the case is in itself quite a difficult question. Perhaps one explanation might be that we are told that women were endowed with greater understanding than men were, and women will very often intuitively sense the truth in a given situation through a flash of insight, while man will arrive at the truth only through a slow, logical, linear progression of ideas. Thus, men need to engage in the developmental dialectic of learning of Torah because they lack the immediate insight that women already possess. But whatever the reason is, it is undisputed that women are technically exempt from the mitzvah, from the command of learning Torah. And since women are exempt from Torah study, and the public reading of the Torah is designed to fulfill the mitzvah, the command of learning Torah, only those who are obligated should actively participate. Thus, women are excluded not because they are women, but as a consequence of their exemption from formal Torah learning, which may actually be a function of their naturally superior spiritual state. They should not really participate in a ceremony designed to be a fulfillment of the command of learning of Torah. Thus, we have two distinct reasons why women should not get an aliyah in the synagogue. Reason number one would be because of the distraction to men, similar to the idea of the mechitza, the physical separation. And reason number two, because women have less of an obligation in the learning of Torah than men do. Now, the first reason, of course, would restrict women from aliyos only in a congregation consisting of men and women. Thus, if we simply had the first reason, this would not apply to an all-female service. By contrast, the second reason, by virtue of their lessened obligation in the learning of Torah, it would be improper for them to recite the blessings even in an all-women's service. There is no specific prohibition for women to simply take out a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, and read from it, as long as no blessings are recited. And indeed, this is the practice that most women's minyanim seem to rely on today. Nevertheless, Most current rabbinical authorities frown on this practice, feeling that something that looks like an aliyah for women will inevitably lead to an aliyah for women. It's very difficult to distinguish between aliyos with a blessing and without a blessing, and ultimately, if a blessing is recited when it is not necessary to do so, there is a profanation of God's name, and this is one of the prohibitions of reciting a bracha levatala, a blessing in vain, which is a quite serious sin in the eyes of the Torah. It should be noted that where the obligations of men and women are the same, which they are not in the case of reading of the Torah, in theory there is nothing wrong with a woman performing a mitzvah on behalf of a man. Thus, for example, a woman can recite Friday night Kiddush for a man. According to a number of opinions, a woman can even recite the Megillah on Purim on behalf of a man. However, where the obligations are of a fundamentally different nature, and women are technically exempt, it would therefore be improper for a woman to perform this mitzvah on behalf of a man, just as is true in any mitzvah, where one party is exempt and the other party is obligated. The party that is exempt should not engage in the performance of the mitzvah on behalf of the party that is obligated. Let me now address the third question, and that is, we have seen that there are certain leniencies that the strict letter of the law would permit. For example, women can get together, they can recite prayers that a woman would have to recite anyway, although they cannot really say the Kaddish, Kedusha, and the Baruch Hu. They can even, under the strict letter of the law, take out a Sefer Torah, a scroll of the law, and read from it, provided that blessings are not recited, at least according to some authorities. But the more fundamental question is, even if the halacha permits certain leniencies, and this, of course, is a debatable question, and one must always consult a reputable halakhic authority, the more important question is it necessarily desirable or proper? The question perhaps should be not if a woman's minyan is permissible, but is it sensible? Is it a mechanism to bring one closer to God? Is it a viable vehicle of spirituality? And here there are a number of factors that have to be considered. To some extent, we in the United States are victims of the prevailing notions of Western culture, and we have perhaps unconsciously absorbed some of the values of Western culture and have attempted to apply them in our Judaism, and through that process have adulterated the values of the Torah and no longer clearly interpret Judaism in its originally understood way. And this is true in a number of respects. First of all, many of us have absorbed the notion that differential roles necessarily connote inferiority, and the fact that men have certain responsibilities and women have different responsibilities under the Torah way of life indicates somehow that women are inferior. That is clearly not the Torah's approach. If one examines the Bible, if one examines the Torah, one sees clearly virtually an unbroken record of a recognition of the righteousness of women, of their great intuition, of their great understanding, of their holiness, which in many instances even surpasses that of men. We look at the story of Avraham and Sarah. Avraham, that is regarded as the first Jew and the founder of the Jewish people, we are told that God tells Avraham, when he was debating what to do with his son Ishmael, who was not behaving properly, Kol asher tomar alacha Sarah shma b'kola, whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. And Rashi comments, because Sarah had a greater level of prophecy and insight than even Avraham. We see the two great sins that the Jewish people committed in the desert, the sin of the golden calf and the sin of the spies, which resulted in the Jews wandering in the desert for 40 years. We see that women were not guilty of that. We find that women had a greater love for the land of Israel than did the men. And thus the daughters of Tzelafchad argued and pleaded with Moshe Rabbeinu to be able to get a share of the wonderful land of Israel. Thus, the mere fact that women are assigned one set of responsibilities and men are assigned a different set of responsibilities does not connote by any means any stigma or any judgment of inferiority. By contrast, a very good case can be made that the differential roles primarily exist because of an innate spiritual sensitivity that women are deemed to have that makes it unnecessary for them to undergo much of the separation and obliteration of the self that public participation in the synagogue and in other religious rites entails. A second respect in which we have been negatively influenced by the prevailing culture lies in the notion that we tend to value the worth of a person by his public nature. We value what a person does in public, and we define religion by its public function. We look at what can a person do in the synagogue. Does a person get an aliyah? Can a person be a chazan? Can a person be a rabbi? And yet in reality we find that in Judaism, the main component of spiritual growth is not what one does on the outside, but rather the innumerable daily struggles that one has to face internally, alone, in the privacy and intimacy of one's heart. And the true measure of spiritual greatness is not what one does in public, although occasionally one perhaps needs that reinforcement, but primarily by the private, secret struggles that one engages in as a private person. Thus, when Avraham was going to sacrifice his only son Yitzchak on Mount Moriah, the Torah emphasizes that it was only Avraham and Yitzchak alone when Avraham had to make that momentous decision. When Yaakov wrestled with the angel, and we are told this is the angel of Esav, and Yaakov was undergoing a spiritual struggle of momentous proportions, and somehow Yaakov was struggling with the Esav, with the evil inclination in himself, and Yaakov finally triumphed. The Torah mentioned this occurred at night when only Yaakov was there alone, because that is the spiritual struggle of man. Very often it is something that one does alone. When Yosef surmounted his evil inclination and refused to succumb with Potiphar's wife, the Torah emphasizes that no one else was around. That to the Jew, service of God is an intimate activity. It is a private activity. It is away from the limelight. It is away from the public glare. And yet, we have become deluded into thinking that the true measure of religious participation is what one does in public. And that is not true at all. Fundamentally, one's relationship to God is forged in the bias, in the home, in the family, in one's immediate environment. And here, the Torah has given women the area of primary responsibility and control. The centrality of the home can be seen in the interesting halacha that when a community is established and there's only a limited amount of funds, the very first structure that must be built is not the shul, is not the synagogue, and it's not even the yeshiva, which is the source of Jewish education, but it is the mikveh, it is the ritual bath, because the mikveh permits the resumption of orderly family life. Because without the family, without the bias, there is simply no Judaism. Nachmanides says in the introduction to the book of Exodus that in the temple there were three phenomena. There was the menorah, there was the candelabra, which had the eternal light. The western light would simply last from 1 week to the next week. There was the shulchan, there was a table that had bread on it, and the bread miraculously would also stay fresh from Shabbos to Shabbos. And there were also clouds of glory that surrounded the tabernacle, which represented the physical manifestation of God's presence. Nachmanides says that these three miraculous events that existed in the tabernacle were really derived from three equivalent phenomena that were present in Sarah's tent. And that is, we are told that in Sarah's tent, when she would light candles on Shabbos, on Friday night, those candles would last from week to week, and that corresponds with the candelabra in the temple. We are told that there was a blessing in Sarah's dough, that anyone that would eat Sarah's bread would feel satiated for the entire week. That corresponds with the bread on the table in the Mishkan, in the tabernacle. And finally, there was a cloud of glory over Sarah's tent, and this paralleled the clouds of glory that were over the Beis HaMikdash, over the tabernacle at a later date. And the Nachmanides makes the point that the temple was intended to be an imitation and a near replica of the divine presence that was in Sarah's tents. And in fact, the Mishkan was an imperfect replica. Thus we see from Nachmanides an amazing insight. We have tended to regard the temple, and by extension the synagogue, as the central institution of Jewish life. And yet we find that the synagogue is nothing more than a mere imitation of the Jewish home, which is exemplified on its highest level by Sarah's tent. We see from this that the Beis HaMikdash is merely an extension of the Jewish home. And how much more so, the synagogue, which is even less holy than the temple itself, will obviously be of secondary importance to the bias. Thus, if we have become enamored into looking at Judaism as a synagogue religion, then we raise questions of why can one person participate and not another person participate. But if we recognize the centrality of the bias, the centrality of the home, and that the home is truly the Merkava L'Shechina, the home is truly the chariot and the resting place of God's presence on earth, and then we will realize that role differential, it does not connote by any means inferiority or stigmatization, but role differentiation constitutes a recognition of a higher reality, that women are entrusted with a mission that is infinitely more precious than that given to men, and that is the protection of the future souls of Israel and the inculcation of Kedusha, of holiness, into the bias. Of the inculcation of Kedusha into the bias, of which the Beis HaKnesses, the synagogue, is merely a pale reflection. One of the most destructive aspects of women's liberation has been the idea that women should obliterate those unique and special qualities that they have in their capacity as women and attempt to simply become men. And if the Torah teaches anything, there is enough of a role of women, and the role of women is exalted and holy enough that it should be pursued not as an attempt to become like a man, but in an attempt to fully appreciate and embrace the unique and wonderful opportunities that the Torah envisions for the Jewish women. And the question, therefore, should not merely be, does the halacha permit women's minyanim or not? Rather, the emphasis should be, what does God want of the Jewish man? And what does God want of the Jewish women? And how best do I serve not my own selfish interests, and not my need for fame, and not my need for public recognition, but how best can I serve in my capacity as a faithful Eved Hashem, a faithful servant of God? This is a difficult question, but it is a question that all of us must ask ourselves, men and women. The mitzvahs were not given to us for our self-aggrandizement. The mitzvahs were not given to us to make us famous, to make us popular, and to serve as our ego trips. The mitzvahs were given to us to faithfully obey the will of God. And ultimately, the will of God is the question that all of us must try earnestly to determine in our own lives.